There are a lot of different ways that this could play out, and some of it could resemble something close to sticking to the Constitution. It could be some kind of end run to game the Constitution, in other words. What I'm trying to say is it might not look like sort of tanks rolling through the streets, but nonetheless, it would be an illegitimate seizure of power.
Welcome to episode 24 of Inside Without Now, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of this show. Today, October 26th, just before I began recording, Amy Coney Barrett confirmed to the Supreme Court, giving conservatives a 6-3 majority. 8 days before an election. This is unprecedented. This confirmation represents a major leap in domesticating the courts and transforming the rule of law into an instrument of fascist atrocity. In the most immediate, this provides Trump with another valuable weapon in his drive to steal the elections. There is very little doubt that her tenure on the court will see a wholesale assault on the rights and lives of millions. A court that will be hostile to the lives of women and girls, access to abortion and birth control. A court that will be hostile to the lives of LGBTQ people seeking to erase them from public society. A court that is hostile to voting rights. A court that is hostile to the environment. As soon as tomorrow, Tuesday, Amy Coney Barrett could become part of the Supreme Court that puts a stamp of legitimacy on a fascist theft of the upcoming election. Trump has openly admitted that his rush to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court is to ensure that the court rules in his favor should the election be contested. And he has shown us time and time again, in word and deed, that he intends to contest it. And for her part, Amy Coney Barrett, during her confirmation hearings, gave us every reason to believe that she'd be a willing and eager instrument in this election theft, refusing to even acknowledge that it would violate the Constitution for Trump to postpone the election, refusing to affirm that armed voter intimidation is against the law, and joined Trump in refusing to commit to a peaceful transfer of power. The remaining check and balance that is left is us. We have to act now, in our millions, in the streets, to stop this fascist rolling coup, to demand the immediate ouster of the Trump-Pence regime before it becomes too late. Today, we are sharing a special interview Coco Das, editor of RefuseFascism.org, did with Ashley Dawson on his recent article in The Guardian titled, "Trump May Try to Steal the Election. We Need to Start Preparing for That Now." Ashley is a professor of postcolonial studies at the City University of New York. Have a listen.
Welcome to Inside Without Now, a podcast by volunteers with RefuseFascism.org. My name is Coco Das. I am a writer and editor for RefuseFascism.org, and I'm really pleased today to be talking to Ashley Dawson. Ashley Dawson is an author, activist, and professor of English at the CUNY Graduate Center, City University of New York, and he specializes in postcolonial studies, cultural studies, and environmental humanities with a particular interest in histories and discourses of migration. And today we're going to talk mainly about a piece he wrote in The Guardian that appeared last week. It was titled, "Trump May Try to Steal the Election. We Need to Start Preparing for That Now." But he's the author of the books Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change, and Extinction, A Radical History. So welcome, Ashley. I'm really happy to be having this conversation with you.
Thanks so much, Coco. I really appreciate you inviting me to speak with you.
I wanted to start by reading the first paragraph of this article, which I think is very sharp and really asks people to confront this moment. You wrote, "Donald Trump has told us openly that he is planning to steal the election. In recent months, he has explicitly declared that any election in which he does not win will have been rigged and illegitimate. He has claimed repeatedly and against all evidence that mail-in ballots are invalid. He and his allies in the U.S. Senate are rushing a hard right-wing nominee through the U.S. Supreme Court in order to ensure that the court will declare him the victor if there is an uncertainty in the results. Vice President Mike Pence refused to say what he would do if Trump refused to accept the election results in his recent debate with Senator Kamala Harris. And most notoriously, Trump has ominously encouraged neo-fascist goons like the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by." And I was wondering, you go on to say how there's very little talk at how to stop Trump, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what rang the alarm bells for you where you felt you had to do research on how to stop a coup. And why is this word coup? Maybe we can step back a little bit and you can talk about, you know, what is a coup and why is it an appropriate word to use in this context? Maybe we can start there and build from that.
One of the things that made me want to write this piece is that I was having conversations with friends of mine, pretty much exclusively leftists, and they were saying, oh, well, you know, if there's a coup, the military, the U.S. military doesn't like Donald Trump, and so they'll probably oust him one way or another. And I was very alarmed by folks who are leftists seeming to just rely on the military to do the right thing rather than thinking about how popular forces would have to mobilize to prevent Trump engaging in one form or another of an illicit power grab. So, you know, when you say the word coup, you think about tanks rolling through the streets. And I think that's what people were reacting to. They were imagining, oh, well, you know, if Trump really tries to send the military in, they're not going to go along with it. But of course, everything in that opening paragraph of mine that you read suggests that Trump is interested in an illegitimate power grab that doesn't involve the military, but involves various different efforts to crimp democratic procedures, whether it's just refusing to go if he loses the popular vote, or casting aspersions on mail-in ballots, and then using the conservative majority on the Supreme Court to keep him in power in some kind of replay of what happened with Bush v. Gore in 2000. So there are a lot of different ways that this could play out, and some of it could resemble something close to sticking to the Constitution. It could be some kind of end run to game the Constitution, in other words. What I'm trying to say is it might not look like sort of tanks rolling through the streets, but nonetheless, it would be an illegitimate seizure of power. And that's why I think it's important to use that somewhat polemical term, coup, just to make people understand the gravity of what's at stake and the ways in which Donald Trump is really planning to shut down the tattered remnants of democracy. And it's important to keep in mind that Donald Trump is in power because of how messed up American democracy is to start with, right? You know, he didn't win the popular vote. He won through the Electoral College, which is a remnant of the kind of era of plantation slavery in the United States. So he's already illegitimate. Some might even say, you know, he holds power today as a result of a kind of coup. And that, of course, one of the things to do once we get him out of power is to completely dismantle as much as we can all of those remnants of racism in the American process and get rid of settler colonialism and decolonize this country. So we have a long way to go for sure. But I think just making people aware of what we're looking at is really important. And to come back around to the beginning of your question, you know, why I wanted to start researching these issues and writing about them, is that just looking at not just kind of the liberal corporate media, like what I was seeing in the New York Times, for example, but also even parts of the left. You know, I was looking at Jacobin to see, which is connected to the DSA, to see if anybody had written about what was going on. And maybe my research was faulty, but I didn't come across anything. I didn't really come across many articles about this and, you know, many articles really trying to make people understand what they could actually do to try and head off a potential coup and what they should be doing, not just on November 3rd, but afterwards. So that's where I was coming from in writing the piece.
Well, I think that's really helpful. And I'm really glad that you looked and decided to take this on yourself, because they're on the left, putting aside what the mainstream corporate media has done on the left, there has been a fair amount of fascism denial, and at Refuse Fascism, we have been using this language of a rolling fascist coup, that this is unfolding right now. He's in the process of stealing and delegitimizing the election right now. And I could not agree with you more that this regime already is illegitimate. One of the things we say is that fascism is never legitimate. By fair or fraudulent election, a fascist regime should never be legitimized. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But I was wondering if you could lay out some of the stakes. I know that you study, you also write about the environment. And if Trump remains in power by hook or by crook, and it's mostly going to be by crook, but if they are allowed, worst case scenario, to remain in power, what is actually at stake for people's lives, for humanity, for the planet? I know that's a big question, but for you, what do you feel are the biggest reasons that we have to actually stop this?
Wow. Yeah, that is a big question. I mean, first, I would just say that one of the benefits of publishing my article, and the idea was to try and get these arguments circulating in the mainstream press in a way that I had found that they weren't, rightly or wrongly. But, you know, one of the benefits of publishing is the articles that I became aware of, organizations like yours and a lot of other grassroots, wonderful grassroots organizations like the Center for Popular Democracy that are helping to mobilize people all around the country in the time up to the election, and then are laying out plans for what to do on November 3rd and 4th and in subsequent weeks. So, you know, I've since become aware that there's a lot of real kind of grassroots mobilization, and I'm very grateful for that. And I hope other people are able to find that stuff as well. That was one of the kind of goals of my article, to suggest that people should be doing this. And then I found out that there's actually quite a lot going on. But to come to the kind of nub of your question, you know, the stakes couldn't be more grave. As you just pointed out, the Trump administration has been engaging in all sorts of fascist tactics from the moment of the inception of his campaign, when he rolled down the elevator in Trump Tower and, you know, used classic fascist tactic of singling out a racialized group, Dominicans and Mexican Americans in this instance, to rally white supremacy and anger to benefit his campaign. He's been absolutely abysmal. But as you mentioned, my work tends to be around issues of climate justice. And I think it's there that the damage that he can do is really at its most profound and lasting. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said that we have only basically the next decade to get to zero carbon emissions. We really have to completely shift the basis of our civilization in the United States. We're the highest per capita emitter with over a century of very, very high carbon emissions. So it's not just that we have an outsized impact in the U.S., but that we play a really dominant role in setting the way things go internationally. And the U.S. has, even before Trump, played a terrible role in diffusing and making it impossible to reach some kind of an agreement. But if Trump is reelected, it's going to get so much worse, right? He plans to pull out of the Paris Accords. He's tried to dismantle most environmental regulation over the last 4 years. And he has supported fossil capitalism, tried to prop up the coal industry, and supported big oil. So we're looking really at locking in a trajectory towards planetary ecocide. By that, I mean, you know, we need to keep in mind that the world has lost about 40% of biodiversity, you know, 40% of the creatures and the flora and fauna on the planet have disappeared over the last half century. And we're on a trajectory towards really exterminating the vast amount of life on the planet in the coming centuries. So we need to make a really, really quick shift. And of course, the way to do that is through a Green New Deal that involves a just transition that gives people jobs, helps frontline communities that are suffering from the damages of climate change and from fossil capitalism. So, you know, we have the ideas and the potential plans in place, but of course, that's exactly what Donald Trump and all of those around him want to prevent. So it's really not an exaggeration to say that we're facing planetary extermination, or something much better if we can get Trump out of power. So yeah, this is where fascism leads, towards ecocide.
Mm-hmm. It really is that there are two futures facing us. It's either an existential crisis on the level of extinction for humanity and the planet, or there's a chance at actually winning a new future for humanity. And every struggle for justice, whether it's environmental justice or Black Lives Matter or trans LGBTQ rights, women's rights. All of this is running now through getting Trump out of the White House and getting his regime out. Maybe we could talk a little bit about how do we define who the opposition should be. I think here there's been a real lack of political imagination, and think that over these last 4 years, there are millions of people who hate what this regime represents. They hate what's happening. They hate that in their name, there are people in concentration camps and kids in cages, and they hate all this, and yet they don't see exactly their role in stopping it beyond voting. And there's been over and over again this reliance on the normal channels. So the Mueller report, the Blue Wave, the court, the Supreme Court, yet all these normal channels are being eviscerated. They're all being torn away to the point where the main way that people see as the way to get this regime out, the elections, is also being destroyed. I was wondering, you know, in your research, but also you talk about various different ways that a coup can be stopped. And how do we actually get people to see their role as being the opposition? I guess here's where I was going with this question. When we look back at Nazi Germany, the question that historians mainly ask, or that people ask, is not why didn't this official in the Weimar Republic stop this? It's why didn't the German people stop this? And that same question is going to be asked of us. So I was wondering, what are your thoughts about the role of the people and also how we convince people that they have this role?
I think it's important to remember that the kinds of groups that you just talked about, queer folk, people of color, women, et cetera, have risen up repeatedly over the last 4 years against Trump and engage in forms of demonstration of dissent, not only in the streets, but also in a consistent way in quotidian life. You know, so think about, for instance, the creation of sanctuary cities, or folks in Portland who turned out day after day after day to protest the sending of various different kind of paramilitary groups into the city. So there's been, I think, really heroic opposition on the part of people kind of across the spectrum in the United States over the last 4 years. And of course, that crested this last summer with some of the greatest demonstrations in the history of the United States, you know, in terms of masses of people. So the problem is, I think people can feel dispirited. And here I'm just kind of going from some of the conversations I've had with friends on the left, many of them activists, because the Republicans hold the levers of the state. And so folks haven't been able to boot him out of power. He's been able to pass so many policies, and the ramming through of this new Supreme Court justice, which is, you know, happening as we speak, is an example of that. I'm from South Africa. I left the country during the apartheid era, but I think there was the same kind of feeling in South Africa. The apartheid government was anathema to, of course, the vast majority of the people in South Africa, including to a large segment of white people in the country, and yet they controlled the state, and the resistance forces had to fight year after year after year in what felt like a stalemate for a long time to eventually topple the regime through nonviolent means. But they won eventually. You know, it took a long time. So it's important for people, I think, to remember that their demonstrations and their kind of quotidian acts of grassroots resistance all do count and all do mount up and will eventually have an impact. And of course, there are particular kind of crux moments when we have to manifest in large numbers in order to really bend the arc of history one way or another. And we're coming up to one of those moments. You know, in my article, I say it's not enough to go out to vote, which is what most of the liberal commentators are saying. It's not enough just to protect the polling sites. You know, we really need to plan for massive mobilizations after Election Day if Trump says that he won when he didn't, or if he says that we have to stop counting ballots for one reason or another, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, we're at this kind of real crux moment, and we have to really fight, because as we're saying, the stakes are incredibly high. If Trump wins, it's not as if our fight will be over. People will continue struggling, you know, for sure. But it is an incredibly important kind of pivotal moment in history, I think.
We only need to look at what we did in June and July when people, millions of people actually rose up and really did actually create the biggest crisis the regime has faced so far. Even though it wasn't directly about what they did, it was about police brutality, and this happened in Minneapolis to George Floyd, it threw the whole program of the Trump regime into crisis. And it sent Trump to his bunker, and we changed the conversation in such a short period of time. And people, unfortunately, forget what they just did. But I also think it points to the importance, and I've studied some of these movements around the world where they did actually drive out these hated regimes. And one of the important ingredients, there were the people in the streets, there was the crisis at the top and the splits at the top where certain parts of the government feel that they have to concede to the demands of the protest. But a very important part of those is the demand that the regime has to go. This was the case in Egypt, in South Korea. It's happening in Belarus right now. That remains to be seen how that will play out. But in Lebanon last year, the demand that Trump has to go, this regime has to go, that's the beginning of getting their hands off the levers of power, which, as you say, is a big reason that they have the advantage and why people get demoralized and deflated and they feel like giving up, because we are up against a juggernaut where they have the wheels of government, the armed forces of the government, they have the violence of their base. But one thing we say in Refuse Fascism is that's all they have. They don't have the majority of the people. They don't have the interests of humanity that we carry. They don't have the right on their side or justice on their side. So this is why popular movements in all around the world and here, that people in the streets actually really frighten these people, that really Trump is terrified of people in the streets. This is why they're going so hard after Antifa and Black Lives Matter, right? There's nothing that scares them more. So the more that we seize that power and build up that power now, the more that we'll be able to put the regime on the defensive, which is the first part of actually driving them out of power.
I think you're right. Can I just very quickly react to something you said?
Yes.
I think it's important to think about the bigger kind of ideological stakes as well. I think that as horrendous as he is as an individual, and he's certainly, because of his behavior, his psychotic, narcissistic behavior, he's certainly brought a lot of horrible things out into the light, which were more subterranean before he gained power. Nonetheless, I think he's also a product of the contradictions of the capitalist system. Neo-fascism was brought to us by the contradictions of neoliberalism, you know, a situation where more and more people were not doing well economically and socially and feeling left behind. And that's why Trump's horrible racist rhetoric and his kind of nationalist appeals, his popular authoritarian appeals, could resonate with people. And the fact is, he hasn't really changed the economic dynamics. In fact, he's vastly deteriorated them. And we're in the middle of one of the worst economic and social crises of the last century or so. I think it's kind of important to remember, as you said, that, yeah, he holds state power and wields that power, but he's completely bankrupt ideologically. And there's only a really hard, diehard core of his followers who are going to hold on to the idea that white supremacy is going to make everything better and that he's really building up their situation when it's clear that he's not. But it's absolutely imperative to make arguments about what the alternative is. And so that also has to be part of what's happening in the present and going into the future. And there are big challenges there because, you know, we have Democratic candidates who don't really represent a big break from the previous establishment. We have to back them in order to get the fascist Trump out of power. But we're also going to have to keep people mobilized going forward.
Absolutely. This actually leads me to, I think, my last question. I thought it was really interesting in your article that you talk about a pledge, the importance of taking a pledge. You had an example in the article, I think it was from some decades ago. And then I sent you the pledge that Refuse Fascism has initiated, which has been signed by you and by many others, including Cornel West and Lily Wachowski, Naomi Shihab, Teaching of Nye, Chuck D. The list of people is growing, but I was wondering if you could just tell me what made you highlight the importance of a pledge. What does a pledge do? And maybe we can talk a little bit about bringing people back to a moral center, the moral argument for what for stopping this coup, I guess.
So a pledge in general and the great pledge which you and your organization have created, I think it makes the stakes really clear. You know, going back to that point we were talking about at the outset about sort of naming what Trump intends to do as a coup, you know, it really makes it clear what his project is, to call it fascism, you know, to say that he's intent on a coup or he's been carrying out a coup in one way or another. So it does that. It also, I think, gives people a feeling of solidarity, and your pledge does that by naming all the people who have been rising up and resisting the Trump regime over the last 4 years. You know, this is a scary time, and I think it's easy for people to feel isolated and alone and kind of helpless, given the fact that, as we were saying, Trump and his cronies hold state power. So knowing that you're not alone is really important. And I think it's particularly important for people with some kind of public prominence to sign on to these pledges, because they have to set a paradigm and be willing to stand up. You know, we've seen a lot of craven behavior in the public sphere over the last 4 years. I mean, particularly within the Republican Party, of course, which, if it ever had any principles, now has completely sold them out in order just to sign on lock, stock, and barrel with Trump. But the same could be said for most of the rest of the political establishment. So for people with some prominence to say, we have to be part of a group of resisting in solidarity against this, I think is really, really important.
Mm-hmm. I just want to end by reading a part of the pledge and then asking if you have any final thoughts for our audience. So I'm just going to read a little bit of the beginning and maybe the end of this. A pledge to the people of the world. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. The Trump-Pence regime must go. We will speak, we will stand, we will shout and march together every day. We pledge to stop a regime that imperils the people of the world and the earth itself. We will take to the streets day after day and call forth others. We demand Trump-Pence out now. We will not stop until they're gone. And one of my favorite lines of the pledge is that we will not hand the future to scorchers of the planet. I think that really speaks to what you were talking about what is actually at stake. I mean, really, we could lose everything. We don't act now to stop this regime from seizing a second term, which would be a catastrophe for humanity. I wanted to ask if you have any final thoughts, predictions, anything. I mean, Election Day is just a week away. We're in the streets now in D.C. We're out by the Supreme Court today to say no fascist confirmation. Trump-Pence out now. We'll be out in the streets. We have plans all week going into and continuing through the elections. But I was wondering if you have any thoughts about, you know, just this week being so close to Election Day, what people have held as something that's going to be decisive. And I was just wondering if you have any final thoughts on what Election Day will be or look like. You've already spoken to what we need to be doing, but...
Yeah. Three things very quickly. First of all, in the section of the pledge that you read, the thing that strikes me is the responsibility people living within the United States have to people in the rest of the world. One wishes that people all around the world could vote in American elections. I'm sure they would go much better, but they can't. And yet this is still the center of global empire. So what happens in the United States has a tremendous impact on what happens for people all around the rest of the world. As I said, I'm from South Africa. People there have been facing drought for most of the last decade. People there depend on rain-fed agriculture. So it really is a matter of life and death to them. It's really a huge issue. It's not just about changing the dynamics within this country, but about the future and about solidarity with people in the rest of the world. I really appreciate that point. The second thing I would say is, again, going back to the liberal media, we've been hearing a lot in polls recently that Trump is nosediving. In fact, I wrote my article about 3 weeks ago and The Guardian wanted to hold it until right before the election day. And I had to argue with them and be like, no, actually, we want to publish it earlier so that we can mobilize people. And so it came out later than I would have liked. And, you know, what we hear in the liberal media is, oh, we don't really need to worry because Trump is tanking. I would say we should not let our guard down, you know, even if he's not doing well in the polls, even if there's some kind of a huge landslide victory, the chances start, he's going to behave very badly in the time after the election, one way or another. And so continuing to keep the pressure up and mobilize is going to be really, really essential. And then the last thing I'd say is thank you to you and everyone else who's out in the streets for the work that you're doing. It's so important. We all need to be out there and feel connected to one another, know that we are fighting fascism and fighting for a better world.
Well, Ashley, I really want to thank you for talking with me. I really think this conversation is important, and the piece that you wrote, and I'm really glad you struggled to get that printed earlier, because it is a really important message, and it's very important that people like you who have a platform play a role in mobilizing people as well. So I want to thank you. I hope we can talk again soon, and I'm sure we'll talk after the election, but I look forward to seeing what you write next.
Thank you so much, Coco. It's been great talking to you.
That was Coco Das, editor of RefuseFascism.org, in conversation with Ashley Dawson, a professor of postcolonial studies at the City University of New York. You can find a link to Ashley's article that was discussed in the show notes. You can follow Ashley at AshleyDawsonNYC on Twitter. And you can read articles from Coco Das at RefuseFascism.org and follow her on Twitter at Coco_Das. Thanks for listening to Inside Without Now. We will have additional special episodes later this week, so be sure to subscribe so that you get the latest. And follow us on social media at Refuse Fascism. Trump is already stealing the election. We need to vote, but Trump will not be stopped just by voting. This is the time to be in the streets, acting on our conscience and using our power of nonviolent protest to demand Trump Pence out now, and to not stop until this demand is won. So go to refusefascism.org to find protests happening near you every day, or get materials there to organize your own. And donate in support of these emergency mobilizations. Click the donate button at refusefascism.org or Venmo refuse-fascism. You can also give via Cash App at Refuse Fascism. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. See you in the streets.